Larry Woodard, and this is Admire. My guest today has had, for the past 35 years, an active leading role in hands down my favorite consumer category, beverages. He has worked at P&G and Pepsi, and was the senior C-suite executive at Snapple, RC Cola, Mott's, and Voss. He is currently managing partner at First Beverage. I welcome to the podcast, Jack Belsito.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for that very nice introduction. Very gracious.
So, Jack, I was reading about how you collected bottle caps when you were a kid and exchanged them for tickets to see the Red Sox. Tell me about that.
Yeah, the Red Sox used to run a promotion every year, send out a chart of all of their roster. And if you collected under the bottle caps of the Coca-Cola bottles in Worcester, Mass., where I lived, they would have the pictures of the players. And if you collected all 25, you could get a Red Sox ticket, which was of great value in those days.
Yeah,
so we used to do that all the time.
Sounds like a lot of fun. We had sort of the same thing going on. I was a military brat in the 60s. I was in Germany, and we'd chase the beverage distributor trucks to get temporary tattoos and other giveaways. And when I read that about you, it just reminded me of my baseball card collection and all that stuff. Do you have other beverage stories from your youth?
Yeah, well, I can tell a story about that. You know, I grew up on the east side of Worcester, and across the street from me was a railroad track. And across that was the Worcester Coca-Cola plant. And we used to wait for the trucks to come in the afternoon, late in the afternoon. When I was small, my mother wouldn't let us drink soft drinks. We never had soft drinks in our house. Probably didn't have the discretionary income to buy them, but my mother was ahead of herself on health and wellness, and so we weren't allowed. So we used to have to sneak the soft drinks. I couldn't have been maybe more 10, 11, 12 years old. We used to make it a point late in the afternoon to see if we could maybe score some Coke bottles from the Coke trucks when they were coming in off the roads. And now I know they were checking in late in the day, and so we would wait for the trains to come, the flatbed trains. They were our protection. We'd run across the tracks ahead of the trains. They were going very, very slow, so not to worry. And we never told our parents that we also rode those trains. But at any rate, we would wait, conveniently run across, grab a few bottles. I now recognize that they were checking in the what was coming back. This was in the days before pre-sale. And I'm sure they saw us. I can't imagine that they didn't see us, and they yell, and we'd run across, and we'd throw the bottles up on the flatbed, and we'd jump on the flatbed and jump off, throw the bottles down, and jump off and see who we got, looking for the elusive Carly Estrella. We have many of those. So, we would fill and then get a ticket, by the end of the summer, hopefully you can get them all. So, and the interesting part of that story, Larry, is later on in my career, many, many years later, it was, 25 years later, I find myself in Canada negotiating a deal with the Coca-Cola guys in Canada. And this is pre-internet and Google. And so we were comparing some backgrounds, and the gentleman said he worked for Worcester Coca-Cola. I said, oh, no kidding. So we quickly did the math and recognized that I was about 10 or 11 years old when he was running that plan. So I told him the story I just told you, and I thought, well, maybe this will break the ice. We've got a kind of a difficult negotiation here we're about to get into. And I can tell you the other gentleman on the other side of that story did not appreciate that story. So I just leave it there. So it surprised me. So.
For me, beverages have always been an exciting industry. When I started working my first job, the Pepsi Challenge campaign was in full swing, and the agency I started at had Pepsi food service business, and we were working the on-premise angle of that campaign. Shortly after I started at the agency, I was assigned to the Canandaigua Wine Company business, which became, as you know, Constellation Brands. What were the circumstances early in your career that led you to the beverage category?
Yeah, I was working for Procter & Gamble in Buffalo, New York. I had started there out of college and got a call recruiting. My only knowledge of the beverage business was that, the cola wars were starting to heat up, and they were starting to take some noise in the public press. I decided to take that role, moved to D.C., and started with a company called Pepsi USA, which called on independent Pepsi bottlers. which I did throughout the mid-Atlantic states. That was the middle 80s.
Yep. So all through the 80s and 90s, as well as early 2000s, beverages stayed front and center. In fact, a major component of popular culture. The endorsers, the sponsorships, the product changes, it just seemed like it was front page news. What was it like being in the business when beverage executives had near rock star status like Scully and Bob Gazzetta?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think Pepsi probably drove that. I think they were more the upstart company in the time, and they kind of had Coke on the run in the 80s through some of the brazen actions. I think the person that sticks out to me most is Roger Enrico, who wanted to be a rock star, wrote a book, right? That I blinked, and that was probably a mistake. I think Pepsi realized that afterwards. They caught the attention of the guys in Atlanta. I think beverages as a badge it's always been something culturally that we have, certainly in the West. It's unlike snacks. It's unlike food. I think partly because of the frequency that we must always have beverage with us. And we have to consume and hydrate, multiple times a day. So that occasion, lends itself to the badge stuff that we've sort of learned over the years. And that doesn't happen with food or snacks, but it happens with beverages. People think, and associate with a beverage and, what that might mean about you, and what it says about you. And that doesn't happen with any other commodity in food.
Yeah, there's something about, just the competition between the brands and the cold case and the fact that there's so much, there's choice and so many, usage occasions, that it just seems that, it's front and center, and particularly before health and wellness became a big thing, the Coca-Cola brand, Pepsi brands, the sort of carbonated beverages did a wonderful job. And I think that that you guys at Snapple were a big disruptor, actually, of that going on.
Yeah, it's interesting because when Snapple first was introduced, it launched a category called alternative beverages. Hmm. Right, so just think about that. That was the category name that Nielsen and IRI gave. Wow. You probably remember those days, and that's what that meant. It wasn't a soft drink, and Snapple obviously had it. Different process, which now we're very used to, which was hot fill. It did change it. It was the dynamic that launched Snapple's interest on top of all the great media communicating, marketing things that the company did in their own stages. But they were an alternative to those big players. But that competition drove intense coverage, communication, interest, and obviously an incredible amount of consumption as well.
Right. I know you probably got hundreds of great stories, about being in the beverage category, and different, clients, brands that you've worked on. Can you give us a story?
I have many stories, many funny ones, but since you're a Yankee fan, I'll tell you a story about, when I was at Snapple and Yankee Stadium. We were big sponsors of Snapple. I mean, of the Yankees, Snapple was. And they had a Snapple Day at the stadium every year. Police Athletic League would join us. It was a great day. It was a lot of fun, obviously, baseball. So the Yankees and we were trying to do more in the city, and the Yankees wanted us to raise their profile with them. They obviously wanted us to spend more money with them. And one of the things they wanted to do is have us throw out the first pitch. So they offered me a chance to throw out the first pitch at Yankee Stadium, which I politely declined. Which stunned them, stunned my marketing group, and they just couldn't understand why I didn't want to do it. And so they persisted for, better part of a week every day, come back. My group would come back into my office and say, hey, listen, Yankees, I really want you to do this. And I would say, listen, why don't we get Wendy to do it? I really don't want to do it. I'd rather not do it. And the reason I didn't want to do it is I love baseball. I never really appreciated having business executives walk out to some place that they didn't belong, to throw a ball for some promotional purpose. It wasn't never really what I was interested in. And that's not how I wanted to develop our brand, That said, they just were insistent. So when they finally came in one day, I wanted to put an end to it. I told them, okay, I will do it. I will do it. Here's, tell the Yankees this. I'm going to walk to the mound. I'm going to wave to the play people in the stadium if there's anybody there that early, but I will wave to them. I'm going to step to the mound. I'm going to reach into my back pocket. I'm going to pull out my Red Sox hat. I'm going to put it on. I'm going to wave again, and then I'm going to throw a strike. And then I'm going to leave. And so they looked at me, and they said, you know what? We'll get Wendy to do it. So, and I never heard of it again. So that was it. The first ball, that's a funny Yankee story. I took a little heat from the Yankees on that, but that's what are you going to do?
That's a good one. You know, I know that being in New York and being a Red Sox fan cannot have been easy, particularly, you know, those times and before. We did some work with George Steinbrenner. We had the Major League Baseball assignment. Let me tell you, that's a rivalry. And during that time when the Yankees were winning, what a rivalry it was.
Yeah, I taught my daughters to read by looking at the box scores. So they turned out to be Yankee fans, both of them. They grew up here in New York, so we're a mixed family. My son is a Blue Jays fan, so I don't know how that happened. Anyway.
So greater health consciousness has really affected the beverage industry with the astronomical growth of bottled waters, new entries like coconut water, and a lot of activity in the functional beverage space. Before we bring it to the present, can you talk about how much different it is to manage and market beverages now than in years past?
Yeah, it's incredibly more complicated. Lots of things have happened there. I think probably the thing that's most impacted has been technology, the ability to see and view things easily, you know, all the way to, you know, your phone, right? So when you and I started this business, Larry, I'm a little older than you, I know, but, you know, sending a message on a brand on your phone, sending a brand message to somebody's phone was Dick Tracy, you know, it's on their wrist, right? So that was just, you know, out of space. And now it's routine, right? And expensive. So it's already, you know, it's caught up completely. So I think the ability to communicate messaging in such a variety of ways and so ongoing has created, you know, an information flow. And that's, you know, that knowledge to consumers is, you know, sort of turned into interest that they've never had around health and well-being, right? And being sure about, you know, what they put in their bodies, more and more people, you know, every day. And so all of that has conspired to create this dynamic, larger filter that we're looking at of choice and variety in almost every category, whether it's, you know, specialty segmentation, et cetera. And that's what the front end of the lens has happened. The back end of the business hasn't changed much. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's gotten worse. You know, consolidation at the distribution level has choked off, you know, a lot of that opportunity, and, you know, creates a much more difficult playing field to get things through. I think variety and choice, probably the biggest difficulty to manage. And when you think about, you know, if you talk to anybody who handles in beverage distribution today, who, you know, who deals with beverage distributors, they will tell you that, you know, distributors today do far less, you know, and do less selling and less management of my business is a constant theme. And that's because the distributors just can't get to everything they have. They're handling way more products with basically the same facilities. You know, you still have to put it, you know, we handle stuff that's heavy. So it might be easy to go up on Amazon and do all the stuff and select, and in 10 minutes you have a deal and, you know, you've paid. Somebody's still got to put it on a truck, roll it to a house, roll it up some stairs. You know, it's physical. And that hasn't caught up. And I think that complexity is probably the most difficult.
Yeah, and it's sort of scary, you know, when you think about the bigs, you know, up here in New York, you know, we've got, you know, CVS is the sort of drugstore behemoth. And I noticed that even when Coke makes an investment and buys a product, that sometimes that just means less, not more, in terms of what you actually see in the store. A lot of brands do a really good job of creating a customer base, you know, only to find themselves, you know, out of the market because there's no shelf space given to them. Some of my favorite products I have to travel to get.
Yeah, Snapple mint tea was always the one people would come up to me. I can't find mint tea; it's my favorite. I would say, yeah, it's my favorite too. You know, but if we handle 50 SKUs, it's hard. You know, so that I think that is definitely become more and more challenging, without a doubt. And consumers are more demanding, so on the front end, that is not stopping. Right. But the back end hasn't delivered, and Amazon has you know, temporarily disrupted all of that.
Right, right.
But they're not making money selling groceries, and they're certainly not making money selling beverages. Not most of them, right? So that probably only has a end of a life cycle. We're not sure where that will end up.
Mm-hmm. So you're now the managing partner at First Beverage. Tell us about the company and the products that you've invested in, or some of them.
Yeah, so company is a private equity company started by Bill Anderson about 12 years ago. Bill's lifelong industry member. You may know him, Larry. Owned business, the beer distributorships and some other things throughout California, Hawaii, as well as in the Caribbean and some other things around the family. He started the company, launched an initial committed fund. That was the fund one. We're currently, then launched a second fund, which is what we're currently deploying capital out of. We look for early stage beverage companies across the complete landscape of beverages. So we're invested in non-alcohol, we're invested in alc, and now we're invested in CBD as well. So we're covering pretty much all the space in beverage. Typically early companies with high growth promise, usually with founders and or players in the driver's seat that we really connect with well on a value standpoint, typically with players who want our help. We're a very engaged type of company. We're not for everybody because of that. Not everybody needs the type of help we give. So we're very selective in who we invest in. We've got some great companies, Essential Water, Health Aid, Q, VitaCup, all companies flying, maturing and doing great. Got a great CBD brand early stage called Mad Tasty, just a relationship we're building with Interscope Records and a gentleman by the name of Ryan Tedder, who was the front man for One Republic, I've become friends with. He's really dynamic guy, really interesting. And that's exciting. We've got a couple of interesting liquor brands. One is a mezcal called Jim Bolt out of Oaxaca, and one is a whiskey out of Colorado called Laws Whiskey, founded by Alan Laws, former Wall Street guy who's been making whiskey in Denver for quite some time now. So we've got a really interesting portfolio. All our brands are doing quite well. Despite the pandemic, a couple are hurt more so, obviously, but we think we're going to be okay through the portfolio. We're happy with what our portfolio looks like.
Mm-mm. Sounds good. And you did mention the pandemic, and I know that we're living through a very tumultuous year here so far. I'm asking all my guests for their perspectives. First, how are you handling the pandemic? What's changed for you, and how are you managing self-care?
Yeah, so we're here in the city, my wife and I. I have two of my children here in the city, one in Queens and one not too far from me in Manhattan. I live in the village, so we've been, we're amid obviously some of the hot spots in COVID. I have one of my daughters in Boston is a healthcare worker at Mass General, and she's been on a COVID for now for the last few months. Continues to test negative, amazingly. So,
oh, great.
And so we've witnessed it like everybody else. We've tried to follow the rules here. We've pretty much shut down. I've noticed that for the most part, New Yorkers have been pretty responsible with this. I think now that's a lot of pressure now, a little bit of human pressure here where we don't really want to be confined too much more, but it looks like at least the New York City response has been pretty good. If we have our politicians maybe not argue with each other, we'd be better off. But that's, I think in general, that's how we've handled it. We followed the rules. I don't always do that, Larry, but in this case, we did. So.
Yeah, as one of your former agencies, I can attest to your fairness in business. You're a former Allen Houston Foundation entrepreneur mentor, and you've been the recipient of the prestigious Frederick Douglass Award from the New York Urban League. Mutual friend Ken Gilbert, who happens to be black, worked for you as CMO at both Snapple and Voss. What do you make of what's going on with race in the U.S. right now? And is this just messy progress?
Yeah, it's more than messy, right? And I don't know whether it's progress yet. I hope so. I hope we can look back on this and say that was a moment where we could cite real progress. I'm not old enough to remember the 60s. I do have some friends who do. They do draw some comparisons to that time. It does feel like we're in some type of enlightenment or recognition moment, maybe a tipping point. I don't know. I hope so. You're well aware, Larry, and these things are we got behaviors so deeply rooted that people who perpetrate them don't even recognize the hurt that they instill. Right. They don't even understand it. So I think I'm hopeful that this stage we're in now, which is, seems like some enlightenment and people trying to find a voice here, all people, you know, of all color, trying to find a way to deal with this. Obviously, people, black people and people of color have had to deal with this, you know, this pressure for, you know, forever, for too long, mm-hmm. you know, since the start of our country. So I'm hopeful that awareness will lead to some change. Starts with police reform. That's obviously what's on people's minds. And I think you've seen some of those things. And I'm hopeful that we can get to a better place there. That won't be enough, right? Until other things happen as well, like primarily around opportunity, right. I would think. And that, you know, when I think about that, I think about, you know, more than just my industry, with business in general, and education, the arts, you know, whatever, entertainment, healthcare, whatever industry it is that is of interest. We need more people of color to be in leadership positions there. We need directorships roles, C-level roles, yep. Ownership. You know, I think that probably leads to access to capital, things like that, and people in power willing to take a chance. You know, I was a young person when someone took a chance on me. Right. I didn't know what the hell I was doing when somebody put me in some of those jobs. And I think it's going to take those types of things. Until that can happen and we can get real representation at leadership and ownership, capital levels, the reforms won't go as far as they can. So I'm hopeful we have a time here, mm-hmm. In a moment. I'm hopeful for it.
I agree with that. I know you're a big Red Sox fan. We've discussed that a little bit. And sports is one of those things that we've been missing since the pandemic canceled sports earlier this year. What do you think about the upcoming shortened baseball season?
Yeah, it's interesting when you think about social change and social response. I mean, the closest we have is sport. It's probably why we love it so much, right? I love it so much, and you do, right? Because it really is closest. So maybe that's what we miss. We certainly miss the competition. I'll take what we can get. I feel for the players and their families, right? I think that's real, despite the money that they make. But I understand it. I think everybody would love to watch a baseball game. There's nothing I would much rather do tonight than do that. If there were one on, I'm watching Korean baseball 5:30 in the morning. Yeah. So just to get my fix. So I'll watch. I think we need to do it carefully. I'm a member of the Athletic Director Council at BU. Mm-hmm. We've had many, many conversations about, you know, when we play fall athletics. You saw that the Ivy League canceled fall sports yesterday. We play the Patriot League, so mm-hmm. that's, you know, possibly that we'll be doing something similar. So I think if we can keep people, the athletes safe, we should play the games. And I hope we can. I think we'll have to see. I will watch, though. There's no doubt about that. I will tune in.
I'd like to thank my guest, Jack Belsito of First Beverage. This has been Admire. I'm your host, Larry Woodard. Thank you for listening.